April is National Poetry Month, and Public Radio 90 observes the occasion by presenting readings by poets from the Northern Michigan University and surrounding communities. Musician and poet Claudia Drozin is a native of Brooklyn, New York, who now lives with her family in Marquette, Michigan. Claudia is principal flutist in the Marquette Symphony Orchestra and an adjunct faculty member in the Music Department of Northern Michigan University. She has an MA in Creative Writing from Northern Michigan University, where she was a preliminary poetry reader for Passages North, and a BFA in Flute Performance from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her poetry has appeared in the Poetry Society of Michigan's Peninsula Poets, Lit Up, the Driftwood Review, Lips, Water Music, the Great Lakes State Poetry Anthology, Jewish Currents, and Maiden Voyage.
Cove Cottage, Hancock, Maine, August 59. There is no warning about magic, unless you try to stand your brain on its head, squint and strain to think backwards, and even then you might be making things up, wanting to skew your retrospective thinking in favor of, oh, of course, everything was absolutely pointing to it being a different kind of night. So you say to yourself things like, yeah, there were so many more fireflies starring around the cottage than usual. Or the dog was acting weird. Wouldn't even take a milk bone. Well, this particular Maine summer night, me, 6, to my brother's 11, I believed in magic. It gets stupid cold up there. It's kissing Canada. Brooklyn knows. But Maine tends to forget that August is still a summer month. This up-north kind of summer makes you shiver dizzy, but it's the good dizzy, like when you spin around and laugh. Our vacation land was starfish, barnacles, chowda, quirky olda people, unafraid to tell you what's what. It was Maine coon cats thick enough to store enough warm to be just fine under the stark mooned chill. Even the moths showed pluck, barging into the cottage, buzz slamming against the hurricane lamp, even our faces without as much as an I'm sorry. After dinner, Dad brought a bag of our scavenged lobster shells outside to the dumpster near the 55 two-tone blue Pontiac. He told us it was the stillest night he could remember in a long time, and the sky was as clear as a bell. I wasn't sure why a bell was clear, but he was the grown-up. Mom was just glad no bats followed Dad into the cottage on his way back in. The second day of our vacation, my brother, Mark, who I called Cram because we were on a backwards name kick, had taken manly control and fired his Daisy BB gun to protect us from a bat stuck in the chimney. Not tonight. Tonight, the hatches battened, the belly of the Franklin stove swallowing applewood, a bit damp but workable. We went to bed. There were just about no waves kicking up in the sheltered bay. I was allowed to stay up pretty late in Brooklyn, but here, with no TV, life was quieter, and we got so yawny, even though Mark said he felt like a baby, our early bedtimes became a game. We liked pretending to be country people. When Mom tucked in the double-thick blankets, I felt pinned into place, my legs and chest hugged by the weight. Because I was 6, I could certainly get up and run around if I wanted to. So when I found myself jolted awake, scooped out of a dream by my dad's strong arms and taken, still blanketed, outside to see my breath, I wondered why he thought I needed to be carried, and how it could be morning already. What happened was, Dad had heard the raccoons making noise outside and flew out to see what they'd done. He didn't follow up, though. The sky stopped him in his slippered tracks, and he knew he had to wake everybody up. He yelled for Mom and Mark to come here to see something. Until I saw a hint of a smile forming on his lips, I was a little afraid that he was mad or something. Once out on the deck, overlooking the water, I squinted my eyes open enough to see that it wasn't morning at all, at least not morning enough for the sun. How great to be allowed up! And up was where Dad said we should look, straight up. He had bought us books about the night sky when we were really little. The pictures of celestial phenomena were pretty cool. Mark had a lithpec then, and thelestial sounded pretty dumb. Anyway, he shouted, "It's the Aurora Borealis!" Mom gasped, but she still tried to be momish, so she whispered to Mark not to scream and wake people further down the cove. I wanted every sleeping person to wake up, but I couldn't scream. I couldn't say anything. The whole sky was lit and dancing like someone had gone crazy and Crayola'd pink and green wavy curtains all over the world. I was hardly cold. Queen of the Hill. I'm in my 60s. Sophie, the neighbor's kid, her early single digits. I go out back to beat the hall rug against the house. From the deck, I check the thermometer, 24 degrees. I watch Sophie, as she does most days, just sitting on the sled hill. She has on a smile and a snowsuit, no sled. Her doll dons a blue winter jacket, one mitten, tiny earmuffs. Synthetic yellow hair looks like it's been cut with a serrated knife. Sophie is bored with her pretend child today, and because she can, she takes charge, pushes her off her lap, watches her tumble until her rigid body is stopped by a snowy stump at the bottom of the hill. She collects her doll, puts her mommy hand to her hip, and talks to it like she's an angry god. You are bad, you know. Don't ever fall in the snow like that. No TV for you today. Sophie will play there when the snow has gone, maybe dressed in airy shorts and a little T-shirt, black flies buzzing around her. I'll find her lounging on the warm hill made of young, itchy grass. She'll be the queen of the new season, giving orders to her doll, just trying to raise her the best she knows how. Dreaming Grandma Celia Alive. On huge gray mornings before stepping anywhere at all, I dream Grandma next to me in read-in-bed position, telling crazy, wonderful stories about how things have a way of working themselves out, how everyone is a song, even evil people. We just need to understand the lyrics. How dusting is a way of sharpening our eyes, showing us the true meaning of a table. Grandma, if I could stay in quilted, keep dreaming you, I mean like forever, the forever of styrofoam, taxes, third world hunger. I realize I couldn't. I realize that my body would stiffen, atrophy. But my newly born mind would take on the comfort and calm of nuzzling a baby chick, the egoless joy of squirting Ready Whip into its cerebral say-ah mouth. Her bowls and that spoon. She is a veterinary technician, my daughter. She is grown up now. When she can, she comes to the UP to breathe, to visit, to see her water, to be really home. Part of home is her rote movement to the kitchen cupboard that holds the dark red glass bowls. It doesn't matter if she's had a number 3 extra cucumbers at Jimmy John's along the road on her way up. She wants cereal 5 minutes after she arrives, and it wouldn't be cereal in another bowl. She talks to me about work, her boyfriend, do I like her new glasses, on top of the familiar clatter, honey bunches of oats hitting the rim, a few flying onto the floor as the dog celebrates her return. I paid $1 for 4 of those bowls at St. Vinny's many years ago, when sippy cups accessorized the table, flannel-backed vinyl was the dinnertime decor of choice. Now they are etched by the dishwasher, having been through so much. They don't say Mikasa underneath. They say nothing at all. But they stick around and they do the job. The bowls are chipped now, but not enough to get rid of. I know I'd catch hell if I just tried it. I do have pristine bowls that even shine, but she doesn't notice them at all. In the hierarchy of kitchenware, there is a pecking order. Her favorite spoon is not as big a deal as the bowl. But she likes the one that's the size of a teaspoon, yet has a rounded soup spoon look to it. It was part of a free set I got for depositing money in the bank. The flowers are just about worn off. It's the one that bends like crazy when it meets the Ben and Jerry's. I've suggested she use the proper tool, a scoop. Nope. She just bends the spoon back after each use, and if it's not available at the moment, she washes it. Yes, you heard me. Our visits go well. She comes to me to share her life when she can get off work, and she needs these bowls, her spoon, the way she needed a doll at 5, her grandma to spoil her when I said no. She's hungry for the security of knowing what's behind the cupboard door. I keep those bowls around and wait for her to come. If one shatters, there are still three more on the shelf. When the spoon breaks from metal fatigue, I'll be there to console her.
These National Poetry Month readings are a Public Radio 90 production, recorded and produced in the facilities of WNMU-FM at Northern Michigan University. I'm producer and host Kurt Hosworth. Thanks for listening.